Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community.
Once some guy went so far to say, try to imagine no heaven, no hell, and no God. No king, no country, not even possessions. We all thought he was asking a lie. So we kept on fighting for all of this stuff. But it never turned out to be reason enough to justify losing people we love. Yeah, that's what we did before the end of war.
Peace Talk is a monthly program produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It's VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for this evening's program. This week, Congress will be voting on the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. Last week, President Obama and the Senate agreed on a compromise version of this bill that will give Congress the power to review the final agreement on Iran's nuclear program. The deal represents 2 years of negotiations with Iran by six nations, including the United States, Great Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany. It is intended to ensure that Iran's nuclear ambitions and capabilities are limited to the peaceful purposes permitted under the terms of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This remarkable piece of diplomacy became possible when Iran elected a new president in August 2013. Hassan Rouhani replaced Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the hardliner who came to power during the Bush administration. Ahmadinejad's rise to power can be attributed, at least partly, to President Bush's unwillingness to engage with early Iranian attempts to resolve the problem. Since the start of this diplomatic effort, it's been surrounded by controversy here in the United States. Even before Republicans took control of the Senate, members of both parties have sought to impose new economic sanctions on Iran that could have derailed the negotiations. But Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry have pressed on and are moving closer to finalizing the deal. To help us understand what this potentially historic agreement means to America and the hurdles that had to be overcome, I spoke with Paul Piller last Friday. Paul spent 28 years working with the U.S. intelligence community. He retired in 2005 and is currently a security studies program faculty member and researcher at Georgetown University. Let's hear what Paul had to say. Why don't we begin with talking about your history with the CIA and the intelligence agencies and how it's relevant to the current situation in Iran.
I had a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, which was mostly in the area of the Middle East and South Asia. I also worked on counterterrorism quite a bit. My last 5 years before I retired 10 years ago, I was the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia at the National Intelligence Council. What that means is I was the senior person for managing and coordinating community-wide assessments. That is to say, ones that involve not just the CIA, which was my home agency, but also all of the other member agencies and bureaus of the intelligence community on political and economic matters, basically, in those regions. So at that time, Iraq, of course, was a big thing, which caused a lot of agony. But Iran was very much in my bailiwick. And earlier in my career, I had supervised analytic units within the CIA that had specific responsibility for analysis on the Persian Gulf region.
Well, and the history of U.S. relations with Iran goes back quite a ways. Obviously, before you began working for the CIA was involved in overthrowing a democratically elected government back in 1953. That is relevant today in terms of trust between nations. Can you elaborate on what happened then?
Both the United States and Iran and their populations have had ample reasons to be distrustful of and even to be antagonistic toward the other side. You're referring to the overthrow of the Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953 and the restoration to what became more complete power by the Shah. There's been a lot of history written about that particular incident that has discussed to what extent the U.S. and British, I might add, roles dominated, and to what extent it was more a reflection of Iranian internal politics. I don't need to get into that, but the important point for the present is that certainly the widespread belief on the part of Iranians of multiple political stripes is that this was basically a U.S. instigated overthrow of, as you say, a democratically elected leader. Probably the other single biggest source of resentment and distrust by Iranians of the United States came in the closing months of the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, when there was an accidental shoot down of a civilian Iranian airliner over the Persian Gulf by a U.S. Navy cruiser. It was a tragic case of mistaken identity. The naval crew thought that they were being attacked by military aircraft. That was not the case. But to this day, most Iranians, I think it's confident I can say this, believe that this was a deliberate shoot down a civilian airliner, not an accident. So those are probably the two biggest points in the history, the troubled history of U.S.-Iranian relations, which have stuck out for Iranians. For us Americans, I think it's pretty clear what sticks out. It was in the very early couple of years of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that, of course, was the hostage crisis, the taking of 50 of our diplomats prisoner in November of 1979, and being held hostage for over a year until Ronald Reagan became president in January of 1981. One finds it hard to think of a worse way to start off a relationship with a new regime in another country than something like that. And we, of course, we Americans are quite justified in dwelling on that. That was a horribly offensive act. I know personally some of the people who were the hostages, and I admire for them for how well they've come out of that psychologically. But anyway, those are the, shall we say, the most salient points in this troubled history that have underscored the distrust on both sides.
Well, in the 80s, when prior to the jetliner being shot down, we were at Iraq and Iran were at war, and the United States' position on that seems to have been to support Iraq. Does that play into the picture?
Yeah, that certainly is. And well before, as you say, the airliner shoot down, which was 1988, the Iran-Iraq war went from 1980 to 1988. And there was a definite tilt toward Iraq, with the one exception being a tilt, if you will, briefly the other way in what became known as the Iran-Contra affair, in which through the Israelis there were some arms shipped to the Iranians in the hope of getting hostages released from the Hezbollah group in Lebanon. But for the most part, it was a tilt towards Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And that, too, is part of the litany of grievances that Iranians still remember when they think of the United States.
And when did Iran get added to the State Department list of state sponsors of terrorism?
I don't remember the exact year. It was back in the 1980s. And this, of course, had to do first and foremost with the very close Iranian relationship with, indeed, being the midwife of Lebanese Hezbollah, which was the perpetrator of a whole series of incidents in the 1980s. I mentioned the hostage taking, but even more salient were the bombings in Beirut, including the bombing of the Marine Barracks in 1983, which until 9/11 was the act of international terrorism that had claimed more American lives than any other, plus the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in the same year and the embassy annex. And given that the perpetrators of that group were closely allied with and supported by Iran, that was the major reason for it.
So, and before the Iranian Revolution, back I believe in the late 60s, early 70s, Iran ratified the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, which is very relevant to what's going on today.
Iran has been a party to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, for quite some time. It's something some people often forget in discussing this this newest nuclear deal still in the making. And in particular, in discussing things like, you know, how long would the particular restrictions under the deal being negotiated would apply. Entirely in addition to that, and apart from that, Iran has now, and they will continue to have, unless they formally withdraw from the treaty, the obligation not to produce nuclear weapons, just as any other party that is a non-nuclear weapons state to the treaty has that obligation.
Well, North Korea attempted to, or advised the international community that they were withdrawn from the treaty. What are the terms for doing that?
It, as is common for this sort of treaty, there's a notification period. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's basically, you know, give advance notice. I think, you know, what we need to emphasize when it comes to things like obligations under the NPT not to build nuclear weapons, the obligations work insofar as it is in the interests of whatever country you're talking about to continue to observe them. It's not a matter of the Iranians, much less the North Koreans or anyone else, sitting around a table with a bunch of international lawyers who are wagging their fingers and saying, no, no, you're not permitted to do that under international law. No, that's not the way international politics work. That is not what is the ingredient of decisions that go into something like whether or not to build nuclear weapons. And certainly in the Iranian case, we've seen a decision made by the leadership, certainly as represented by President Rouhani, but there is no doubt, based on what he said himself and other indications of what's coming out of Tehran, that this applies to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, as well. They have decided that it is in their interest and in the interest of Iran to seek a future for Iran in which it is firmly a non-nuclear weapon state, and closely related to that, that they will get at least a partial release from the international purgatory that they've been in with these various sets of sanctions and become more of a normal player in the international system, politically and economically. And I must say, I would certainly agree with their assessment. That is in Iran's best interest. A nuclear weapon is not going to help them. And that ultimately is what it comes down to. And so it's up to us, the rest of the world, not just the United States, if we want to encourage that kind of thinking and confirm in Tehran a commitment to that course of action as a non-nuclear weapon state. It's not a matter of negotiating some legal clause that enables international lawyers to wag their fingers. Rather, it is to provide the sort of incentives with regard to the trades that are made over the negotiating table that makes it clear to Iranian leaders that sticking to that course of action as a non-nuclear weapon state and being reintegrated into the community of nations economically and politically is in and will continue to be in their best interest.
When did it begin? When did Iran begin, or we think Iran began, attempting to move towards developing a nuclear weapon?
Well, I don't think we know, you know, everything that's worth knowing on this, but I think the more relevant data points that have become public were with some of the unclassified assessments of the U.S. intelligence community, which put a date of 2003 of when they stopped working on weapons design and weaponization work. I don't know that we can really, to answer your question directly, I don't think we can answer it directly in terms of a starting point. We should note, as far as the nuclear program overall is concerned, not weapons work, but the, you know, the peaceful program, that started way back under the Shah. It is not a creation of the Islamic Republic. It began earlier in the 1970s.
So, and that's for nuclear power and nuclear medical type of research.
Well, just the entire program, yes. And that is, of course, those are the stated purposes that the Iranians all along have said are the reasons they have a nuclear program, power generation and medical isotopes, and just sort of quote, research, unquote. they have never acknowledged that they've had an interest in weapons or that they did weaponization work, and we wouldn't expect them to do that. That is to say, to acknowledge that. This has been the case all along for quite some time, again, going all the way back to the time of the Shah.
Well, in 2003, you said we got information that they had stopped, we believe they stopped working towards nuclear weapons. It's my understanding that they were negotiating with the European Union, so they made overtures to the Bush administration to develop an agreement. Is there anything behind that?
Well, there's been a whole history before the current negotiations that really got rolling once President Rouhani was elected almost 2 years ago. Before that, we've had a troubled history of lost opportunities. There have been a couple of them. One that was right around 2003 during the Bush administration, when Mr. Rouhani, by the way, was essentially the lead Iranian nuclear negotiator. And there was an opportunity then and an initiative by the Iranians to strike a deal back then, which would have been very similar to what we're talking about today, except instead of going into the negotiations with the Iranians having something like 19,000 centrifuges spinning, they had, I think, barely a couple of thousand, and they would have been limited to even less than that. The posture of the Bush administration was, well, twofold. One, if we want to talk about the nuclear program, then we don't want them to have any uranium enrichment at all. And number two, you had people like the vice president, Mr. Cheney, saying, well, it's an evil regime and we'd really rather not talk to them at all. And then you had a subsequent opportunity lost in which the Turks and the Brazilians took the lead. Along with the cooperation of the West Europeans in trying to come up with a formula that involved various concessions by the Iranians about shipping enriched uranium out of the country and being subject to certain limits. And that came a cropper, too, because of U.S. resistance. So the big change came 2 years ago in 2013 with Rouhani's election and the Obama administration's seizing of that opportunity so that it didn't go, it wasn't lost like those earlier opportunities were. And the result was the negotiation really rather quickly within a couple of months of what became known as the Joint Plan of Action, which was the interim agreement under the terms of which the parties have continued to live and the Iranians have continued to observe now for some year and a half.
So the hard line now from conservative side of Congress and pundits across the country is this is not a good deal. In 2003-2005 timeframe, when the Bush administration didn't want to talk to them, obviously they didn't feel there was any possibility of having a good deal. And what we wound up with is a hardline Iranian government that basically produced what you said was a lot more material.
Well, what we wound up with in response to the U.S.-led strategy of simply applying pressure with increased economic sanctions and the hope that at some point the Iranians would cry uncle was that they never did cry uncle and they continued to expand their program. And we've had, you know, then a subsequent decade, basically, of stories about and press coverage of how the centrifuge count has continued to go up and up. Before they stopped doing so as a result of the Joint Plan of Action that I alluded to a moment ago, they were enriching up to the level of 20%, which is quite a ways, actually it's most of the way up to bomb-grade material. We ought to draw a couple of lessons from the experiences of the previous decade. One, when you go for the so-called perfect deal, which in the eyes of policymakers in the United States at that time was not allowing any peaceful nuclear program at all, or certainly no uranium enrichment. Not only aren't you going to get it, you're not going to get a more restricted version of what you could have gotten at the time. And secondly, it demonstrates how the pressure version of how to get a so-called better deal simply doesn't work. We've tried that route, and we've seen the result.
Well, aren't we sort of in violation of the treaty ourselves if we're prohibiting a country that has signed the non-nuclear proliferation treaty agreeing not to develop weapons if they claim, and the evidence shows that they're only developing material for peaceful purposes, and we prevent that, aren't we sort of violating the same treaty?
Well, you're referring to provisions, not just the NPT and other, but in other internationally agreed language, to the effect that countries that forswear nuclear weapons do have a right to peaceful nuclear program. One of the, as to whether or not that's technically a legal violation on the U.S. part, I'm not sure, since it's not a matter of the U.S. in particular, you know, being obligated to assist this country or that country. You know, what we've done is apply the economic sanctions and then try to get this backed up by U.N. Security Council resolutions. But you're certainly correct that it violates the spirit of the whole nuclear nonproliferation global regime. When you have a party that has forsworn nuclear weapons, does not have nuclear weapons, according to the public judgments of the U.S., and I might add the Israeli intelligence communities, has not decided to build a weapon, and then try to keep them from even having a civilian program. Now, I think the significance of what's been agreed to so far, both in the preliminary agreement, the JPOA that I referred to before, and now this so-called framework agreement that was announced 2.5 weeks ago, that the Iranians are willing to subject themselves to even more restrictions than they really have to or are obligated to restrict themselves to as a member of that global nonproliferation regime and a party to the NPT. The Obama administration has quite properly pointed out that when it comes to something like the extraordinary inspections and intrusive inspections that the Iranians have already agreed to, it is a level of inspection in terms of the frequency and intrusiveness that goes beyond what any other country has negotiated for itself to and submitted to itself. So I think it's fair to say, and the Iranians are quite right to say this themselves, that they are going above and beyond what they have to do. But you've raised the very important point that there are two sides to, actually more than two sides to the nuclear nonproliferation regime. Not only it's a matter of limiting all but the those who made it into the nuclear club first, like ourselves, prohibiting everyone else from developing nuclear weapons. It's also a matter of preserving and protecting the rights to a civilian peaceful program. And I might add the often referred to Article 6 of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which obliges the current nuclear weapon states, including us, to take meaningful steps toward nuclear disarmament. And that's another thing that the non-nuclear weapon states have frequently reminded us and the Russians of, that we've reduced our arsenals quite a bit, but we still, now it's been almost half a century since the NPT was signed back in 1968, we still have quite a few nuclear weapons in our own arsenals.
Let's back up a second. You mentioned something about the Israeli intelligence. I didn't quite catch what you were saying on their view of Iran's nuclear program.
Well, perhaps I overstated a bit in terms of publicly declared positions, but the U.S. intelligence community, as it has been expressed on its behalf by General Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, has on multiple occasions now in their public assessments before Congress and in their unclassified documents have judged that Iran has not decided to build a nuclear weapon. And there have been reports, and I can't recall exactly the right channel, but I think it's more a matter of press coverage of, you know, some other comments that Israeli intelligence leaders have made, that they basically don't disagree with that. You know, despite what their prime minister may be saying in his speeches and rhetoric, the assessment of the Israeli security apparatus and intelligence agencies on this particular question is basically the same as what the U.S. community has publicly said its assessment is.
Well, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has been saying that Israel or Iran is close to a bomb for 15 or 20 years. Isn't that true?
Actually, more like 20. Yeah. It goes back to the 1990s, probably the early 90s when he first started making speeches about this.
So right before the latest framework was signed, there was a letter sent from 47 senators to Iran. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, you're referring to the letter that was written by the freshman senator from Arkansas, Tom Cotton. It was an open letter to the Iranians that said, basically, dear Iranians, don't trust what the Obama administration might be doing with regard to negotiations, because realize that we in Congress or a future president could undo anything that the current U.S. leadership might negotiate. I personally thought, and obviously many people agree with me, given the reaction to the letter, that that was an absolutely outrageous attempt to undercut U.S. foreign policy. There was a lot of backpedaling by many people on the Republican side, appropriately so. I think that that indicated just how far beyond the boundaries, to borrow some of President Obama's terminology, some of this debate has gone. I think the one other thing to take note of is that Senator Cotton, who was in his first few months as a U.S. senator and was the author of this letter, deserves some credit for being honest on his basic objective. He has made it quite clear in other statements that his objective is to kill the deal. He doesn't want any agreement at all with Iran. So give him credit for not trying to persuade the rest of us that the objective is to get a so-called better deal. You know, we hear that a lot from some of his other congressional colleagues. We hear that from the Israeli prime minister. But it's quite clear it's Senator Cotton who's speaking the truth. The objective is to have no agreement whatsoever with Iran.
Well, and we've got a senator, a freshman senator as well, Dan Sullivan, who took the position and has written op-eds in Alaska's newspaper saying that it was only to get the president to bring the deal to Congress.
Well, this gets to one of the more recent stories, which is this bill written by Senator Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And the big news during this past week has been the agreement reached within that committee to a modified version of Senator Corker's bill, and the White House decision to cease trying to oppose this legislation and to say they are willing to accept and the president will sign the modified version. The most important thing I think we need to note about the Corker bill and what others, including your senator, have mentioned about congressional prerogatives is Congress would have the prerogative and the power to do whatever it wants in terms of approving, disapproving, condemning, supporting, withdrawing funding for the implementation of an agreement, whether or not you had Senator Corker's legislation or not. Even if the bill was never passed, Congress could still pass resolutions of disapproval or approval in the first 30 days, the first 60 days. It doesn't really matter. So it's always struck me as a bit of a subterfuge to say, well, this is really all about congressional prerogatives. I think some of the Democrats who have now signed on to the modified bill are quite happy in particular to say that. And the hope on the administration's part is that having now cast and still to cast in the full Senate a vote in favor of this bill and making themselves look tough on the issue of congressional prerogative and being able to tell their constituents that they aren't just following White House orders, that they might find it easier when they have to vote on the substance of the agreement. If a resolution of disapproval does come up before the House and the Senate after a deal is signed, if a deal is signed, that they will then be able to feel more political space to support the agreement after having made this gesture supposedly on behalf of congressional prerogatives. But let's let's be honest, because, as I say, this bill didn't really, wasn't necessary in the first place for Congress to protect its own powers.
Well, and it doesn't rise to the level of a treaty. Dan Sullivan stated, you know, or referenced the constitutional requirements, congressional consent to reach create a treaty, and that would have required two-thirds of the Senate to approve. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, but I mean, the important point is the vast majority of international agreements that the United States reaches these days are not treaties that are subject to Senate advice and consent. I mean, it's really a tiny percentage that have taken the form of treaties. So this is just another, well, to borrow the president's words in his press conference about a week ago, a way of using procedural issues to try to screw up the deal. Not only have the vast majority of international agreements, which administrations of both parties have reached in recent times, not been subject to Senate confirmation as treaties, but even things that have to do with nuclear weapons. I mean, some of the deals that have been reached with the Russians have not all taken treaty form. And moreover, and even in contrast to that, this agreement, as we've seen the outlines of it, at least in the framework agreement that's already been announced, does not have any effect whatsoever on U.S. military forces. It doesn't affect U.S. laws in the sense of what U.S. citizens are obligated to do. It's not. It doesn't involve a decision for the United States to go to war or not to go to war. These are the fundamental sorts of things where you might say a treaty is really more appropriate. But no, this is. The handling of this agreement as not a treaty subject to Senate confirmation is very, very much in line with what administrations of both parties have done.
This is Peace Talk on KTOO in Juneau. You're listening to a pre-recorded interview with former CIA officer Paul Piller. Right now we're going to take a pause from Paul's assessment about the Iran nuclear agreement and listen to the Atom Bomb Song, which was written, performed, and produced by Juno's own John Palms.
Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. Anyone has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. Anyone has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You gotta wonder who they might drop one on. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You've got to ask yourself who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb, has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb, has their own atom bomb. Just think of all the fingers and all of the triggers and how every day the risk gets bigger. Someone somewhere in the world will use one of their atom bombs. You've got to ask yourself who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? Just think of all the fingers and all of the triggers and how every day the risk gets bigger. Someone somewhere in the world will steal one of those atom bombs. You have got to ask yourself who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? If it ever came bearing down that we were under attack. How many more of them would we fire back? Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You've got to ask yourself who gets to decide. Time we put away our own atom bombs. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb, has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb, has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You gotta wonder who they might drop one on.
That was the Atom Bomb song by John Palms. Now let's return to our conversation with Paul Piller. One of your comments hinted that there's a attempt by the opposition to this. It's a posturing to look strong. Part of what President Obama has experienced and should expect to experience the next 2 years with Republicans in both, controlling both houses, is a lot of resistance to anything he does. But also, how much of that is going on versus possibly how much interference or influence from outside lobbies with the Israeli lobby, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the Saudi Arabian government?
If I were to summarize the sources and bases of opposition to this impending agreement, I would say three things, and you've just touched on two of them. One is the position of the Israeli government, the current rightist Israeli government, which is one of adamant opposition to reaching any agreement with Iran. The prime minister may talk about the terms, he may talk about a so-called better deal, but he's been moving the goalpost all along, and he continues to try to do so. I think one way to emphasize that point is to recall his speech to the United Nations General Assembly year before last, in which he had his famous cartoon bomb and was drawing lines on it with a red marker. What the joint plan of action, the preliminary agreement that the Iranians have already agreed to and have been observing for the last year and a half, does is basically drain Mr. Netanyahu's bomb. You haven't seen him trot out that prop again. It'd be nice if he did, because what it would illustrate is the very point he was raising back then has been achieved. So then when something like that gets achieved, the goalposts get moved again. He had been talking before these negotiations reached even the stage of the JPOA that something like a one-year so-called breakout time with regard to what Iran would need, and if they decided to suddenly make a race for a bomb, would be sufficient, or he certainly seemed to be suggesting that. Now, with a deal where the Obama administration has made it very clear that 1 year is what they are very firmly negotiating for, then now we're hearing, well, that's maybe not enough. Previously, we heard that the nuclear issue was the sine qua non, excuse me, more important than anything else. Now we're hearing a lot more, from the prime minister and his government about these other activities that Iran is doing in the region. We can talk about that, too. So there's been a lot of goalposts moving. There is no doubt in my mind that government does not want any deal with Iran. It doesn't want it. Because it doesn't want to strengthen one of its principal competitors for regional influence by having it cease to be totally a pariah. It does not want to weaken opposition to Iran as one of the chief rationales for an extraordinarily close U.S.-Israeli security relationship. It does not want to weaken its claim to be the only worthwhile partner for the U.S. to do business with, certainly on security issues in the Middle East. And it certainly does not want to weaken its ability to use the specter of Iran and the possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapon as the all-purpose diverting and distracting issue to refer to anytime anyone raises, especially with regard to the occupation and the Palestinian issue, things that government doesn't want to talk about. Whenever those other issues are raised, the immediate reply by Mr. Netanyahu or his ministers is, well, the real problem in the Middle East that people ought to be talking about instead is Iran and this nuclear program. So there's extremely strong opposition from that government. adamant opposition. It's not going to be appeased. And going with that is everything that implies in terms of the influence of that government in American politics and the associated lobby, which has manifested itself on so many other things. So that's one main base of the opposition. A second main base, which you touched on, is to sum it up quite bluntly, the oppose anything Obama does mindset that exists among many of those in the opposition party in Congress, which is now the majority party in the two houses of Congress. This nuclear agreement with Iran, if it is achieved, would be a major foreign policy accomplishment. I think most observers, both Democratic and Republican, would view it as probably Obama's biggest foreign policy accomplishment. It would be kind of the foreign policy equivalent to the Affordable Care Act on the domestic side. Well, if you're a Republican who is determined not to see this president get any significant achievements, then that's another reason to oppose this deal. And I see a lot of what's going on, including the Senator Cotton letter and other votes yet to be taken, as growing out of that. So those are the two fundamental sources of opposition. Then I would add a third that is sort of played on by both of those two, and that is a larger sense by the American public of a need for an enemy, a need for a bad guy, that throughout the Cold War, Moscow and the Soviet Union served so well. But particularly since the end of the Cold War, we've needed somebody else, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has served that purpose. And along with that is a tendency by us Americans to look at the world in really black and white terms, and not only that we need an adversary, but we have the sense that we shouldn't do any business with an adversary. Adversaries and enemies like the Islamic Republic of Iran should only be ostracized, pressured, sanctioned, adamantly opposed. There is a strong tendency in broader American public thought to think in those terms. That's unfortunate. I think it's not good for American foreign policy, but it is a sentiment upon which those other two sources of opposition, the government of Israel and the oppose anything Obama does, can play and are continuing to play.
Well, President Obama, and I believe a piece you wrote back in January said was titled something like there's not a better deal coming than what this one might be. President Obama has basically framed this as either we have a deal, or there's two routes to war if we don't have a deal. John Bolton, the former ambassador to the UN during the Bush administration, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times basically saying we should bomb Iran. And I believe there was a Washington Times or Washington Post op-ed that had echoed that sentiment. What are the possibilities that we could go wind up in war if we don't have a deal?
We need to be careful in distinguishing the different specific positions of people who are opposed to this deal. You mentioned John Bolton, probably one of the more extreme examples, but again, give credit to him for honesty in terms of what he's seeking, who has specifically said, I want a war. There have been a few others. Joshua Marabchek was another a prominent neocon. And let us not forget, it wasn't all that long ago that Senator McCain, former presidential nominee, now the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was jocularly saying, bomb, bomb, bomb Iran. I am not one who would say that, you know, war is the inevitable result of a failure of this deal. Certainly the chance and the risk of war goes up appreciably. I think as long as President Obama is in office, you know, for the remaining not quite 2 years, he's not going to launch a war. And I think even the right-wing government in Israel, and we will still continue to have, it looks like, a right-wing government in Israel under Mr. Netanyahu, realizes as they look at their military capabilities and also look at going to back to what I mentioned in terms of their motivations for opposing the deal, wanting not so much to, you know, take out Iranian capabilities, but to have that issue hanging out there as the all-purpose issue to keep referring to justify, you know, other things they do. I wouldn't expect the Israelis, you know, to go to war. You know, the following month or any time soon after a deal was defeated. They, of course, have other means that they can use to try to screw up a deal. And what I would fear, you know, reading about someday in tomorrow's newspaper is that, you know, a couple of more Iranian nuclear scientists have been murdered. That would be a very bad thing for a number of reasons, but most of all for the current purposes, screwing up the remaining negotiations and perhaps killing a deal. I think that the risk of war, if the deal is killed, would go up for a couple of reasons. You know, the overall level of distrust and animosity would be that much greater, and we would be losing an opportunity to lower it. You would certainly be increasing the incentive in Iran, or to be more precise, increasing the political clout of those people that we would generally consider hardliners in Iran, who might still think that, and some people in Tehran still do think this, that it would be a good idea to develop a nuclear weapon. And of course, if the deal falls through, then all those restrictions under which Iran has been living for these last year and a half, and the even tighter restrictions that they would if the deal were completed, those would go away. If the U.S. Congress kills the deal and more sanctions are applied, then bye-bye to all those other enhanced inspections and limits on uranium stockpiles and prohibition of 20% or even higher uranium enrichment. The Iranians could start doing all those things again. I don't think they would do all those things overnight. They would not want to appear to be the ones who were capitalizing most on a collapse of the deal. They would want to underscore that the responsibility for collapsing the deal rested squarely with the United States. And as a result, they would have a good hope of seeing most of the rest of the world getting away from the sanctions regime and their economy improving. But there's no question that the risk of war, which might be just touched off by some incident, be it a naval encounter in the Persian Gulf or something else, that neither side intended to escalate into war, might escalate nonetheless. That's how a lot of wars have unfortunately started.
So the deal isn't perfect. You've referred to it as the best deal we can get. You mentioned that some senators are claiming they're holding off or think we should hold off, or Netanyahu thinks we should hold off for a better deal. But this deal's not perfect, obviously. So what do you think are some of the potential weaknesses in it and shortcomings for the United States?
Well, there's been no shortage of commentary about that, especially, of course, from those who oppose having any deal. And we could go through a whole list of things. I'll mention a few, but before we do, let me emphasize that on just about every of these points that have been raised, the question that has to be asked is, what is the alternative? And on just about everyone, you have to say the deal, even this imperfect deal, gets us farther and is more in support of our interest and does more to assuage our concerns than if we had no deal at all. Well, just start with the whole uranium enrichment business. Sure, it would be easier for all of us if they didn't have an enrichment program. Then we wouldn't have to worry about these breakout time issues and what's the difference between an IR1 centrifuge and an IR2 and that sort of thing. If one made the worst case assumption that Iran was going to at some point in the next few years suddenly say, okay, we're trashing the deal, we're going to break out, then, you know, having some kind of enrichment program as opposed to none would give them something more than what would be just a standing start from zero. But again, you know, what's the alternative? If we don't have this deal, then they've got at least what they've got now, and no doubt, given the history of the last 10 years or so, more than that, more centrifuges, more enriched uranium stockpiled, and much farther from a standing start. Another area that's often talked about is the possibility of secret facilities that have not been declared by the Iranians, totally clandestine sort of program that they could use to build a bomb in the future. A very legitimate worry. We ought to worry about those. Again, the question is, what difference does a deal make? Well, a deal still is dealing with declared facilities, just as the International Atomic Energy Agency has always dealt with Iran and everyone else. So you can't get overall policing. You can't put inspectors in every district all around Iran and hope to uncover some secret underground facility that hasn't been declared. But again, we certainly wouldn't be any worse with a deal than without a deal, as far as the possibility of a sneak out toward a bomb with clandestine facilities. And to the extent there is any difference made by the deal at all, our chance of uncovering any such undeclared facility is greater with the deal than without. Greater because of the inspection arrangements and their intrusiveness and their breadth. Some of the ways in which the inspection arrangements, as already announced in the framework agreement, would go beyond what has been applied to Iran or anyone else for that matter up to now is really comprehensive coverage by international inspectors, not just of the enrichment facilities and the research facilities, but also uranium mining. And it's generally known, where the uranium resources in Iran are. So if the Iranians wanted to put together some kind of clandestine program, given that you've got the inspection going all the way back to the source, uranium ore, it would be very, very difficult, or certainly more difficult under these inspection arrangements for them to have some kind of sneak out capability than without a deal. And then finally, there's been a lot of, just to mention one other of many that opponents have raised, the whole issue of the length of the agreement and how long Iran will be subject to particular terms. There's been a lot said about, if such and such restriction only applies for 12 years or 14 years, then they'll just wait that long and then they'll break out and build a bomb. Well, then, the question to ask is, would you rather have them have that sort of breakout capability right now, or would you rather buy the 10 or 12 or 14 years? We should further add that it's the norm for international agreements to have sunset clauses and not to subject the parties to certain restrictions forever, especially when they are these extraordinary special restrictions that no one else has subjected themselves to. So these are just some of the major points that have been raised. They do represent legitimate areas of discourse and discussion and debate. But one always needs to couple that discourse and debate with the key question, what's the alternative?
And if we do get a deal, does it create a path to improving relations elsewhere with Iran? And what does it mean for their current president? Does it strengthen his position when his reelection time comes up?
Well, let me start with the second question first, because the first question really plays off of the second one. There's no question that there will be substantial impact on Iranian politics. They have politics just like we do. They have contending factions. And just like in our political system, who's up and who's down has a lot to do with who's succeeding and who's failing in their policies. That's going to be the same case with President Rouhani as it will with a leader in this country. He has staked an awful lot of his political future on this negotiation and getting a deal. Expectations have already risen quite a bit about economic improvement that the Iranian people hope to get from sanctions relief associated with an agreement. And we saw crowds greeting Foreign Minister Zarif when he came back from Lausanne, Switzerland. And it was certainly economic improvement they most had on their minds in greeting the foreign minister. A successful deal, if it's signed and it's implemented and it goes into effect, that definitely will help Rouhani's reelection chances. And it will further cement the current balance of forces in which the Supreme Leader is definitely weighing in support of his negotiators, in support of Rouhani, keeping the hardliners contained But if the whole thing falls through, the political situation in Tehran is much different. Rouhani would be little more than a discredited lame duck. He probably would have a hard time winning a second term. The supreme leader, given the caveats he's already expressed all along and his distrust of the United States, which is, by the way, is a genuine distrust based on some of those things we talked about earlier, he would say, okay, I told you so, you know, I let Rouhani give it the best shot, and we see once again that the Americans are not to be distrusted, and so to heck with them, no more business with the Americans. And the hardliners would gain politically, no question about it. That has implications for your other question about overall Iranian-U.S. relations. Yes, a successful deal would open up a path to more open and more effective diplomacy and doing business with the Iranians on a whole host of other issues, mainly regional Middle Eastern issues, in which both of our governments are interested. Sometimes our interests conflict. Sometimes they converge or run parallel, as they do to quite an extent right now in Iraq, for example, in trying to push back the group known as ISIS or Islamic State. Both sides have wisely, in my view, during these last 2 years, focused pretty narrowly on the nuclear issue, because if the agenda started getting broader, both sides, which have grievances against the other, would keep broadening the agenda and nothing would get done and we would have no chance of an agreement at all. But once this issue could be more or less laid to rest, and both sides could say, okay, we've come to a compromise, here's the deal, we're both committed to observing it, then I think this would lead to something closer to normal business between these two important countries that both have major interest in much of the Middle East.
Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point? I mean, you've given us quite a bit to think about already.
I think we've pretty much covered things. I'll just leave as my closing thought the question that I've emphasized a number of times before, but it can't be said too often. Consider the alternatives. You're going to hear a lot over these next 2.5 months as the rest of the agreement gets negotiated about not only the particular details we talked about, but many, many other things, all kinds of nitpicking and things that aren't really nitpicking, but you know, legitimate pointing out of weaknesses and areas of concern. You always got to go back to the question, all right, what's the alternative? And one of the things that diehard opponents of this deal or any deal with Iran have consistently done as part of their strategy is avoid talking about the alternative, with only a few exceptions like Mr. Bolton, who's quite open in saying his alternative is war.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time today, Paul. I appreciate it, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Okay, I was glad to be with you.
This is Peace Talk. You've been listening to an interview with retired CIA officer Paul Piller that was recorded on Friday, April 17th. If you tuned in late and missed Paul's expert assessment on the nuclear negotiations with Iran, you can find it on ktoo.org. Go to Special Programs and then Focus on Community. That's our show for tonight. I'm Rich Moniak, and on behalf of Veterans for Peace, I want to thank Paul Piller one more time for sharing his knowledge on this important foreign policy issue. Thank you for joining us, and good night.